or happiness, if you like. And knowing that, once you pursue pleasure within oneself, that's what it says over there, once you pursue the pleasure of the mind inside, ajatang. Ajatang means inner pleasure or happiness. Bhikkhus, there are these five cords of sensory pleasure. I don't know where they got the idea of cords from. It has nothing to do with the Pali. It just became just, Rice Davis started this, five cords of sense pleasure, but five sense pleasures is far enough. But anyway, five types of sensory pleasure. What five? Forms cognizable by the eye. A beautiful sights. Beautiful people, beautiful movies, whatever it is you like to watch. Sounds cognizable by the ear. Just Beethoven's Fifth. What else do you like? Ajahn Brahm's amazing, inspiring talks on audio. Wonderful it is. Sounds cognizable by the ear. Odors cognizable by the nose. The smell of dewy. You know what happened in Perth? No, it's in Sydney. Just a couple of months ago, there was one of the colleges in Sydney University was closed down. The SWAT team and the hazmat, people in hazmat suits came. They thought it was a terrorist. They evacuated the whole college. Hundreds of people had to leave. And the people with their machine guns, the anti-terrorist group, the SWAT team, and because there was a noxious gas, everyone wearing these hazmat suits, like it was a Novichok attack, you know, as it was in Salisbury in England. And they just looked. They didn't know what it was. It's hard to identify, but they followed it to its source where it was strongest. It was inside a locker of one of the students. So they very carefully, sort of, I don't know if they blew it open, because you don't know what's inside, but they managed to cut it open and they found the attack. It was a piece of jewelry which was glazed. And that actually happened. Closed down part of Sydney University. It was gas. That's what it was, gas, yeah. Gas masks and stuff, the whole works. I think they left it there for a few days. So, but even just flashes, sometimes you might call it the terrorist attack group. Anyway, odors cognizable, flavors cognizable by the tongue. And tangibles cognizable by the body. Oh, this feels good. A nice massage. Soaking in the hot tub. That are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensory desire and provocative of lust. Those are the five types of sensory pleasure. The Kama Sutra. It reinforces very clearly that when it says sensory pleasure, it refers to the five senses. Now the pleasure and joy that arises depending on these five causes of sensory pleasure is called sensory pleasure. A filthy pleasure. You know what it means, filthy? It means like the same word as urine. Now please excuse me, this is the Buddha actually being quite gross here. No, like it means the worst word for, no, please excuse me, piss. That's what it actually means. Milha. Sukha. So it's a filthy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure. I'll say this kind of pleasure, it should not be pursued, it should not be developed, it should not be cultivated, that it should be feared. Now here we got these four words which always come together, but in the negative this time, which is well, I only know in the positive. Nabayitabang is not to be is feared. This is Bayita Bang, to be feared. Bahudikata Bang. There we go, I've got it here now. Na Ase Witta Bang, Na Bawaita Bang, Na Bahudikata Bang. Not to be followed, not to be developed, not to be made much of, to be feared. That type of sukha. Here, monks, quite secluded from sensory pleasures. Actually, it doesn't actually say Kama Sukha. It says Kama, K-A-M-M. This is Vivichehi Kamehi. And there's sort of an error there, because we're talking here, introducing the first jhanas and the rest of the jhana realms. It's not Vivicha means secluded, Viveka, no, from the five sense pleasures. It's more than that. It's the five senses themselves. Vivichehi kamehi. From the five senses. But obviously, when the five senses are gone, the five sense pleasures are gone too. Quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni or upasaka or upasika, you too can enter jhanas. You don't have to cut your hair off to get into jhanas. And in fact, there was this gentleman who came on one of my retreats, it was about a year ago, and he, I just happened to be by the registration desk, where this gentleman came in. He was Australian, Caucasian, he was wearing Australian national dress, which was thongs, shorts, and a singlet. That was all. We call that Australian national dress. Just like he'd come from the beach. And he had so many tattoos on him. Really rough tattoos. And he's big and he looked really sort of rough. And as many of you who visited monastery in Perth, it's only 6 kilometers from the prison. And so when he came in, and I did, you know, what I should never do, just to judge people on their appearances. And I said to him, "Sir, I think you've got the wrong place. The prison's up the road." Then now I'm on your retreat. Really? And I checked his name. It was true. He was on the retreat. So, you know, let him in. Last person I thought would ever go on a meditation retreat, but he was there. But then a few days later, when he came for interview, he was the one, he was a star meditator. He got a jhana. This fellow. Wow. That's what if you, so the message there is, if you want a jhana, get some tattoos first. No, I'm only joking there. It just showed that anybody, you know, can, you know, with the right instructions, doing the right things, you know, can experience these jhanas. Sometimes the last people I ever expect. There's, when I told that story, other people got very upset. These people, they just come for the first time to your retreats, never seen them before. Say, "I've been coming to this place for the last 20 years, you know, supporting, joining the committee, working hard, giving donations." So sometimes it's, you don't know, if you just let go. And then these things might happen. So anyway, quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk, nun, lay man, lay woman, enters upon and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. This is called the bliss of renunciation. The bliss of seclusion. The bliss of peace. The bliss of enlightenment. I say of this kind of pleasure, this kind of sukha, that it should be pursued. That it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, it should not be feared. And this, I pause on this because even now it's wow. The bliss of renunciation, Nekama Sutta. go all the way to India to see the four holy places where the Buddha lived. A bit cheeky. It's good to go there. You get lots of inspiration. And you know the real four holy places where the Buddha actually lived? And you can go there without needing a passport? The four holy places, the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. That's the four holy places where you can sit where the Buddha sat. And I'm not just saying that just for personal gain or whatever, but whoa, that's really powerful stuff. Anyway, so as reference to this, I say this kind of pleasure should be pursued, developed, cultivated, should not be feared. So if any time you get close to that with nimittas, or you get jhanas, if any monk or whatever says, oh, don't do that, you get attached, it's creating fear in you. The Buddha said, it's not to be feared. Oh, stop doing that. No, to be followed, to be cultivated, made much of. Not just to monks, to everybody. Anyway, I'm just really getting excited about such things. So any questions about some of that? Really, not many questions today. Okay, we'll keep going.
A question.
You got a question?
There are some pleasures that are not the five sense pleasures and not jhana. Like the pleasure of discovering new mathematics or physics laws or doing philosophy. How will you classify those pleasures? Is it to be pursued or not to be pursued?
It's pursued because things like inspiration. You know, sometimes I do get tired. I'm getting old. You know what it's like, so we're all getting old. And I don't know how old you are now. You're in the 70s, are you? 60s, 68s, whatever. Well, I'm 67 for 68th year. But you know, you just get tired, and sometimes you run on inspiration. Seeing wonderful people do wonderful things. And that inspiration, especially in the Dhamma, that is the stuff which is a pleasure to be followed and not to be feared of. You know, you see some people, I'm not talking about great amounts of money, but even some really poor people, or even more than that, someone who hasn't got any time. They're busy, but they stop and help someone who really needs help. And some of the inspirational things which I've seen, they just, wow, brings real energy up, that type of energy, which is not of this world, called Niramisa Sukha. Amisa Sukha is, yay, I've won the lottery! Yay, my football team won the World Cup! Yay, I'm getting married tomorrow! Yay, oh, my first kid has just come. That might be sort of inspiring at first, but it's very expiring soon. But the pleasures of the mind don't have a use by day. They're very powerful, those types of pleasures. So, in particular, just to ground it in suttas, things like reflecting on your generosity, jag anusati, remembering the sila anusati, remembering the buddha anusati, dhamma anusati, sangha anusati. All of these are part of what's called later on the 40 meditation objects. Things which do give rise to very beautiful pleasures. If it's like mathematics or something, it'd be a bit of, I suppose, a bit of inspiration. Just how even beautiful this world runs, just with the language of maths. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Can you go to the mic? Yeah, so that it can be recorded for the...
Yeah, Jens, questions about jhana. Is it a point or line of no returns that once you cross it, it will be a difference that you can't really returns, or it just make the whole person to be
different. Okay, it depends on the intensity of the jhana and also just how you understand it. For example, there's many people who got jhanas, such as Devadatta. No, he just used that as more fuel for his ego and superiority complex. There's other people who, you know, I've come across who had a jhana, but they weren't particularly spiritual people. They were usually in a very difficult place in their life, and they had nowhere to go except let go and go inside. They didn't sort of make much out of it, but some people did. You know, it was a very powerful and striking experience, almost unforgettable, and they wanted to find out what the heck that was. But it doesn't, you know, have just never a bad effect on your life, only a good one. So, you know, if you've still got lots of duties in the world, you know, such as your family, and, you know, you have to still work to pay off your mortgage, and, you know, you just be able to work much more efficiently, be a much kinder person, and just be healthier too.
So it's not a case of, because I have a perception that relating first jhana to stream winner, second jhana to
it's not a case. It's something similar, but you do need, as well as the jhanas, you need the instructions. What's it all about? The jhanas are sometimes like the flashlight, the torch. The Dharma is like the map. You need both to be able to find the treasure. So the jhanas, you know, create the light, so you can actually see where you're going, you know, in the forest. But you need the map to find out where the treasure is. So some people have the map, they know the Dharma backwards. They're professors of Buddhism. They don't have the flashlight, the jhanas. You have both, and then you're going to find the treasure.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Okay. Very good. Okay, you have to come to the exercise is good for you, says one of the fat monks, who's a bit of a hypocrite. But
earlier on, Ajahn mentioned something on how to deal with fault. I think you mentioned that to avoid conflict, one should focus on the act of wrongdoing and depersonalize, avoid pointing out to the wrongdoer.
Yeah.
It seems to me this sort of this recommendation applies quite well to adult-to-adult communication.
Yeah.
But do you think that this is appropriate in a context of an adult-to-child?
Yeah, sure. You tell them, you know, it's not nice, it's not pleasant to hit your little sister. Oh no, it's not nice, pleasant to hit anybody. But don't tell it, you know, it's in him, because they say, well, she does it to me. So it's just depersonalizing it means the act is focused on. I need more practice doing this, because even saying it's not nice to hit your sister, it's not nice to hit anyone.
No, I guess I'm speaking from the point of view of, say, a parent to a child.
Yeah, parent to a child, yeah.
Because as a young child grows up, you know, they should be guided as to what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
And to make them learn faster, that they should be sort of given the idea that one is responsible for one's act.
Yeah.
And it's actually a personal thing.
Personally, I see where you're coming from.
Then, you know, the effectiveness of guidance is not there.
I think against that is sometimes people, even kids, think they're always being told off. And they take it too personally. So, I think we'll probably experiment, find a middle way there. But I know that, mummy never loves me, she always tells me off. Clean my room, sort of wash behind my ears, wear a new pair of underpants if I go out in case I have an accident. And those are things I remember from my mother. It's almost a bit too putting me down. So sometimes, I don't know, just find out for yourself. Oh, overt and covert. So as we reference to this, one should know how to define pleasure. Knowing that, one should pursue the inner pleasure. One should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt speech. So it was said, with reference to what was this said. Here, monks, when one knows covert speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. You know, just, hey, have you heard what that Dr. Victor Wee's been up to? You don't do that. You know, it's really nasty. Here, so if you know it to be untrue, incorrect, unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. When one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should still not try. One should try not to utter it. But when one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it, knowing the time to do so. Because sometimes criticizing somebody in public, oh, that causes a huge amount of problems. And, well, there was a case recently which I knew about, I was very disappointed with, and because it led to somebody's suicide. There was a gentleman in Hong Kong. He was on, I think, one of the retreats, I think just at the the end of the range retreat. And he came over there because he's, it's actually the beginning of the range retreat at Jhana Grove. He came with his wife because, you know, he had been accused of sexual harassment or abuse in his office in Hong Kong. He totally denied it. His wife said, no, he didn't do this. A couple of people had it in for him. So when they brushed past them, they put a complaint in for sexual assault. And he was so depressed by that, he came to get some guidance, some strength in the retreat. But then recently, his department named and shamed him. And the police had never, so the trial hadn't come up yet. The police, you know, he was anonymous because that was the law. You can't say this until the person's actually proven guilty. Named and shamed in the morning, in the afternoon he jumped from the balcony and killed himself. So that was, you know, so unnecessary, cruel, and resulted in somebody's death. That's, you know, if you are going to say something, the right time and the right place. And for him, that should have been in a court of law, not prior to the trial. So anyway, so be very careful what you say. To you it may be fun, to you it may be just trying to get your own back. For some people, they can be so sensitive, they can just commit suicide. So, the right time, the right place, if at all. If it's untrue, keep quiet. Don't mention untrue words. If it is true, then, even then, right time, right place, if at all. Here, monks, when one knows overt, sharp speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. When one knows overt, sharp speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should not try not to utter it. When one knows overt, sharp speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one may utter it, knowing the time to do so. Overt, sharp speech, the right time and place, shouting at somebody, is that always right, always wrong? If I see somebody, they're just crossing the road and a truck is coming, say, Victor, quick, get out of the way. I will shout at you, Victor, in order for you to save your life. I won't use soft speech. Victor, there is a truck coming. You know the right time and place. Which is one of the reasons there was a very weird phenomena in the Northern Territory. They noticed in the Northern Territory on these long straight roads, you know, there were many The trucks and cars going really fast, no other traffic, so that many animals, were killed on the road. But they call it roadkill. And the crows, it was really weird, the crows, who would actually eat some of the roadkill, this carrion, and the crows, only crows would be killed by trucks, by lorries, never by sedans. They wanted to find out why. So the University of Northern Territory did some research, they staked out the roads, and they found the reason. The reason was that the crows always worked in pairs when they actually got some stuff on the road. Because when they were eating on the road, they didn't know what vehicles were coming next. So they couldn't really see and get out fast enough, so they had to have a friend who would actually warn them. And so one crow would be up on a tree, the other one would be eating. They obviously swapped and took turns. And when one on the top of the tree, they knew how to say, "Car, car, car!" But they didn't know how to say, "Lorry, lorry." Anyway, so you know the right time to say overt, sharp speech. So it's a reference to this that it was said, one should not utter covert speech and one should not utter overt speech. One should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said, here monks, when one speaks hurriedly, one's body grows tired and one's mind becomes excited. One's voice is strained and one's throat becomes hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is indistinct and hard to understand. When we purchased our monastery for nuns, Dhammasara, it was done by auction. And in one case, it was important that the auctioneer got everyone excited. He started off, this is a beautiful monastery, 563 acres of solitude, and I think it's worth, about $1 million. Anyone going to say $1 million? $1 million? Do I hear $1 million? $1 million? And everyone got excited. But if he'd started, "This monastery is very beautiful. Does anyone want to put a bid in?" It would have been, wouldn't get sold, because you get people excited to sell things. And it's the same way you can use your speech to calm people down. For example, if you want to fall asleep at night, all you need to do is to play one of my talks at slow speed and you go to sleep. So the pace of your voice actually does sort of affect the audience and also you. So when one speaks unhurriedly, one body does not grow tired, nor does one mind become excited, one's voice is not strained, nor does one's throat become hoarse, and the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is distinct and easy to understand. So as in reference to this, that it was said one should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. Number 12. I'd better hurry up because I'm running out of time. One should not insist on local language, one should not override normal language. So it was said, hypocrite. One should not insist on local language, one should not override normal usage. So it was said with reference to what was this said. How amongst does there come to be insistence on local language and overriding of normal language? Here monks in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, a bowl, a vessel, a saucer, a pan, a pot, or a basin. So whatever they call it in such and such a locality, one speaks accordingly, adhering to that expression, insisting only this is correct and everything else is wrong. This is how there comes to be insistence on local language and overriding normal usage. And how amongst does there come to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage? Here monks in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, a basin, so whatever they call it in such a locality, without adhering to one expression over another, one speaks accordingly, thinking, these venerable ones, it seems, are speaking with reference to this. This is how there comes to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage. So, in Malaysia, one doesn't speak in Thai or in Pali. One speaks in the local language as best you possibly can. So when I give talks, you know, we try and speak in local language, la. Ayo. Ayo. That does get you to sort of connect a little bit. So when I was over in England, I had to speak with a very polite voice and to enunciate all my vowels because you did not know Her Majesty might be in attendance. But when you're down under, you gotta speak like Australia. Not really Australian, but nevertheless. So in reference to this, it was said, one should not insist on local language, one should not override normal usage. So here, monks, the pursuit of the enjoyment, this is summing up again, the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires, low and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair and fever. It's the wrong way, therefore this is a state with conflict. It's in conflict with the right way. Here, monks, this engagement from the pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire, low and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering. Disengagement from the five sense pleasures. Therefore, it's the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, the pursuit of self-mortification is a state beset by suffering. It's the wrong way. Therefore, it's a state with conflict. Here, monks, I'm just summarizing. Disengagement from the pursuit of self-mortification is the right way, therefore this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, the middle way discovered by the Buddha avoids both these extremes. It leads to nirvana. It is a state without suffering. Therefore it is the right way. This is a state without conflict. Here, monks, extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma is a state beset by suffering. It is the wrong way. Therefore, it's a state with conflict. Not extolling and not disparaging and teaching only the Dhamma is a state without suffering. It's the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Sensory pleasure is a state beset by suffering. It is the wrong way. Therefore, it's a state with conflict. Here, monks, the bliss of renunciation is a state without suffering. It is the right way. Therefore, it is a state without conflict. Here, monks, covert speech that is untrue is a state beset by suffering. Therefore, it's a state with conflict. Monks, covert speech that is true is a state without is still a state beset by suffering. Therefore, it's a state with conflict. Covert speech that is true, correct, is a state without suffering, therefore it's said at the right time, is a state without conflict. Overt sharp speech is untrue, overt speech that is true but said at the wrong time is a state with conflict, it's beset by suffering. Overt speech that is true, correct and beneficial is said at the right time, is a state without suffering, therefore it's a state without conflict. Here, monks, speech of one who speaks hurriedly. Every time I read this, I remember I'm rushing my speech. Speech of one who speaks hurriedly is a state beset by suffering. It is the wrong way. Therefore, it is a state with conflict. Here, monks, the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is a state without suffering. Therefore, it's a state without conflict. Here, insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage is a state beset by suffering. Therefore, this is the state with conflict. Here, monks, non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage is a state without suffering. It is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Therefore, bhikkhus and nuns and laymen and laywomen, you should train yourself thus. We shall know the state with conflict. We shall know the state without conflict. And knowing these, we shall enter upon the way without conflict. Now, monks, Subhuti is a clansman who has entered upon the way without conflict. That's all they mentioned about him. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Any questions, comments, or complaints? You know, when I give talks, very few people, oh, you've got a question. They usually wait towards anyone's finished and then they line up with their questions.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for a very good sharing. I just have a few questions.
Oops.
When we meditate at home or self-practice, do we need to have constant guidance? Do we need to always come to a teacher and update, this is how we are progressing?
No, right. Only if there is something to talk about.
Okay.
So, as long as you have basic instructions, then usually you'll be fine.
Okay.
Sometimes something weird happens, then it's good to go and see a teacher.
Okay. During self-practice, I found that when I close my eyes and do a proper sitting, that's only the time I can get some real peace. But I tried some other techniques because in our day-to-day life as a lay person, I can't really do close eye all the time. So there's the open eye, but I cannot go anything apart from just mindfulness. But I cannot go any deeper. I cannot really go into the peace that I try to get.
That's like normal, because if you did try and meditate, somebody asked this morning, can I do exercise, like running and jogging, and get into, say, nimitta states? And I said, if you did and go into a jhana, you just carry on jogging, you wouldn't know where you end up. Because you have no awareness of your body. Your awareness is deep inside.
Oh, I see.
Or if you're driving me to the airport, please have mindfulness of the traffic, not your breath.
No, because
and for goodness sake, don't close your eyes.
I remember following another Dharma class, Sutta class, and they said that Buddha and the Arahants, because once they achieve enlightenment, they are perpetually in either Jhana 1 or Jhana 4, even though they are awake.
Now that is Gomayang.
Okay, that's what I heard.
I don't know why they said that. That's
my third question now, I think. You mentioned do not be fearful in practicing and entering into all these states. Is there any kind of attachment to any of the stages that you cannot progress? Should we be aware of that attachment? Because even jhanas, they have different types. They have, I think you have sukha and piti, ekagata, and then towards the end, there's only equanimity left. So do you get, is it a natural thing, or you don't get attached?
It's a natural thing. If you do get attached to the jhanas, the pleasure of the jhanas,
it's okay.
You can get attached to them, but there's only four possibilities for you. That's stream-winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment.
Okay.
That's what happens if you do a lots of them, not just one. And the attachment to the jhanas, the only real obstacle that is, that prevents you from going from a non-returner, anagami, to full enlightenment. That's the only place where there's an obstacle for you.
Yeah.
But for many people, becoming an anagami, a non-returner, they'll be quite happy with that at the end of their life.
Yeah.
So basically, it's not really an important attachment.
Okay. And Ajahn, there's one last question. Actually, I don't quite understand this one statement, insistence on local language and overriding, the word overriding of normal usage.
Okay.
I seek clarity on that.
Sometimes the local languages, they could have the refined language. Like, how many languages are there even in Selangor? In this state? Selangor. In the state of Selangor, there must be obviously Malay, and there must be sort of, there's many different dialects of Chinese, there's the English, and there may be some of the indigenous old languages.
Talong,
yeah. So, I mean, there's so many different languages in different places. So, in other words, you don't insist, say, on Malay, a national language, when you're talking to sort of some indigenous people. So, I mean, that means it gives you conflict. So what are we arguing about? We're talking about the same thing. So, you know, you understand the local languages, or at least, you know, give some respect for them. Especially sometimes when it gets to Dhamma, there's almost like the Dhamma language in terms of India, like Sanskrit, that's the purest, the highest. Don't insist upon that. Use what the locals understand, which means that that gets to people's hearts. You can communicate. So I already mentioned one local language, you know, the China doll. You don't, you know, insist, oh, monks shouldn't say that, because straight away, you know, it's the idioms, the slang words, sometimes that when people understand that, it actually gets much closer into their minds. Yeah, it would say, oh, you shouldn't, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't say China doll. And that's what people use, you know, when they're in the elevator, when they're in the cars, when they're home. Some of the slang terms. Okay. We are finished. So, now we do the three... Oh, do we do the sharing of merits for to our deceased relations? Yeah. Offering the merits to the deceased. Idam me nyatinang. Idam me nyatinang. Hotu sukhita hontu yatayo idam men yatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo idam men yatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. You see, when you speak hurriedly, your throat gets hoarse. Very good. Okay. So, what do you do now? That's it. Okay. Very good. Any announcements?